Brevity codes are designed to convey complex information with a few words or codes. Think of it as a short hack to key information. On this podcast, it's about sharing insights, success stories, and personal journeys across a broad spectrum of disciplines. Welcome to the Brevity Code. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Brevity Code podcast. Today, I am joined by a longtime friend, Shane Baum. He is a pretty decorated eyewear design industry veteran. And so here's just a few of his credentials, and we can kind of dive into some of this fun stuff later. He's a founder, designer, CEO of an independent, heirloom-focused, ultra-luxury eyewear brand, Leisure Society, formerly designed for Louis Vuitton, and alongside of former LVMH creative director Mark Jacobs. He's a CFDA member, Council of Fashion Design of America, which includes fellow designers such as Tom Ford, Ralph Lauren, Vera Wang, Michael Kors, to name a few. Very, very special company there, Mr. Baum. So he's not only a designer, but a gent who breathes and lives his life according to the brand ethos he created. The lifestyle of Shane Baum strives to be the master of the art of living. And that is a true statement. And we're going to get into some of the hijinks of Mr. Baum today. So welcome to Brevity Code, Shane. How are you?
Thank you, Ryan. I'm awesome. And thanks for inviting me to be on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
Well, I think just to give some context, that's a really impressive opening statement and some like achievements that you've, sort of accumulated over the years and working with legends and being in, you know, rubbing shoulders with some of the names that were just mentioned. But it didn't always start that way, did it?
Well, I was just going to say, like, if you want to go through a list of failures, it's much longer.
But, so we started together in Mossimo in probably what, 1995? No, earlier. Yeah, 95, something like that.
Yeah, I had a friend that I met just previous to that. And the other day I was, we were going through a few things. I'm like, dude, you can trust me. We've been friends for a couple decades. And he's like, it's actually 3 decades. I'm like, okay, fair enough. So yeah, it's it's been a bit of time.
So you and I, we were part of working in what they called the cages in Mossimo. Or at least I refer to them as the cages. I don't know if we've ever talked about that. But when people say, you know, like, what was your origin story? I always say, well, yeah, I started at Mossimo in the cages. And there was only two sets of cages. And I was in one and you were in the other. It was pretty close to prison style. Or we could kind of talk to each other through these cages.
Or maybe like a dog hotel or something like that. But yeah, it certainly wasn't very luxurious. And what did your cage do again?
So yeah, my cage, I was responsible for the inventory for the Mossimo supply stores, which he had one at South Coast Plaza in Pasadena. So I would count the inventory in, you know, steam it, hang it, and ship it to the two stores. And that was kind of the gist of it. So it was a warehouse within a warehouse of separated inventory from the inventory he was shipping to, you know, majors like Macy's and Bloomingdale's and such.
Yeah. And I think that during that time for me, my parents were putting pressure on me to put my college degree to use, which I studied like packaging engineering of all things. And then but the summer after college, we were spending the summer playing volleyball and met this dude, Mossimo. And he's like, my company's really growing right now. You know, do you want a job? I'm like, geez, you know, like I need to pay rent. And so anyway, yeah. So I think that about 6 months into that, he just said, I worked in the warehouse, you know, minimum wage, put clothing in boxes and send it to people. And anyway, he just said, like, well, I'm starting an eyewear division and it seems like you're more technically minded based on your education. You know, do you want to, you know, help with the eyewear division? And there was just two people in the division. There's one lady that did all the cool things and me that answered the phone, put the boxes on the shelf and set up a desk in the cage with the high value goods. And but learned to import and export goods and, you know, and how to do production and answer the phone, customer service, computer system, everything else. And so, yeah, I think we met when you started coming into the cage next door.
Was that his first product extension outside of apparel?
Yeah, I really think it was. It was, yeah, for whatever reason, he was excited about that. And there was a lady that was hired that had worked for Bausch & Lomb previously, or Ray-Ban. And so she was super knowledgeable and had been in the industry for a while.
I guess I never realized that. I always thought when I saw you over there that you were a little more credentialed up. I didn't realize it was like, you know, as casual as meeting him playing volleyball on the beach and getting your start. I thought you were already kind of in that, well, I guess loosely, like that engineering kind of design space, because he quickly moved, thankfully, and to both of our credits, we got out of the cages in a relatively short manner and were brought inside the office. And then is that where you really started to do the actual design work, or how did that transpire?
Well, it was one of those things where, the lady that had started the division, left the company. And I remember, it's kind of funny how respect works. And for anybody that's younger watching this podcast, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you start noticing the people that, you know, show up first in the office, leave last, work nights, weekends, like just all committed to the cause. And so you and I would just see each other at hours when the place was virtually empty, you know, and this is the days before, people thought it was a good idea to have, you know, ping pong tables and everything else. It was just like, you know, work like crazy and you'll gain some respect and maybe, you know, move up the ladder. And so, I guess during that time, when that lady left, there was about 3 weeks. And keep in mind that I think, you know, we started when the company maybe had, you know, 30 people all of a sudden, and relatively quickly it had like 100. So it was like a very quickly growing company. So I just remember I spent the entire like weekend just writing like a 3-year business plan for the division as a guy in my, you know, early 20s, and just said like, I want you to make, cause they were like, we have to find a new vice president of the division. And we had hired more people at that point. And so I just wrote the business plan. And so that's when I would see you all the time, just, nights, weekends, just basically live there.
Yeah. That's, I think that's good. I think that's good words. I really hope, and those are things that I try to impart onto my children. And I know you do as well. Yeah. I don't even know if I could justify my own existence there, to be honest. I was way over my skis there, just didn't know anything. And, you know, was lucky enough to be under the tutelage of Jason Johnson, who I've mentioned previously on this podcast, and talking about what an absolute crazy, beautiful genius he was. And how fortunate that my two bosses were, one was Massimo and one was Jason Johnson. It's a very special place to be. And then, you know, like guys like you right outside of my cubicle that I could like look at again for the modeling of like work ethic and just head down, going for it and really earning your spot.
I always think during that time too, I remember very much like when I'd work on the weekends and I'd go in the, you know, this is before everything was completely digital. And so I'd see like reports on the computer and it would be like income statement and balance sheet. And I'm like, well, this seems kind of important. So I'd rip it off and just go in my little cubicle in the cage and just read it over and over and over and do the math on it. This is how much we spend on marketing. This is how much we spend on, this is our gross margin. You know, this is our profitability for the year. This is how much debt we have. And so that was a really interesting thing. And going from that transition from, you know, kind of a startup to going public, was a real learning curve. That was beautiful. And I really remember during that time when you mentioned Jason Johnson, he was like an absolute, genius, the wonderful communicator, huge work ethic as well. Super creative. And so in that whole transformation of, I think this might've been just after you left, but from going public, and bringing in executives from, you know, Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein and Ralph Lauren and all the people that we brought in, you really realize sometimes in a startup that you have like these geniuses that are not well decorated, and they don't have a lot of accolades. And all of a sudden when you're reporting to shareholders and stuff like that, they don't want, kind of like the local genius. They want, you know, more proven people. So I really learned during that time that we had these incredible talents that were actually kind of like kicked to the curb during that time.
That's a great point. And something that I would probably give myself a C when I moved on to Paul Frank. And being mindful of that, I was there. I mean, I remember the execs from Calvin Klein. I remember that when he started to pad the resumes to go public so that it looked a little more official. But, and you're right. I think some of the people that got the brand there and the name out there got overlooked for senior level C-suite positions because they didn't have a department store title next to their name. And that's super unfortunate. And yeah, so when I got up to that same level at, well, not dollar wise, but similar level of distribution as Massimo, I definitely brought in some seasoned veterans, and I think I was a little more mindful of that. But yeah, man, sometimes it's pretty enticing when you know you can hire someone with a big name company behind them, a publicly traded, recognizable name. You think it gives you clout. I mean, it does on the outside, and then it just on the inside, those employees, it's a demoralizing proposition. Like, how have you navigated that?
Well, I think, you know, it's always like you said, enticing when you're like, oh, I'm a tech company and we're on the come up and we just hired this person from Apple. And I have no idea how many employees Apple has, but it's a lot. And so you're like, you know, were they, instrumental in the growth of the company, or did they have a cubicle there and played a lot of ping pong at lunch and kind of went for the ride. So, you know, finding, true talent that's willing to, you know, and it's one of those things, like, you know, I always tell people, you know, when they go to work for this company, it's like, you know, this has got to be your life. You know, you got to, you work nights and weekends. There is no downtime, but just teaching people the work ethic of like, yeah, there's nothing wrong with getting up, you know, to go to the bathroom at 2 in the morning and responding to a production problem, you know, in Japan. Because they're working, you're going to save a day. And so those kind of things have seemed to be lost on a generation. And I don't want to be like super old school, but I think anybody on the come up would, you got to kind of get the tattoo on your face of any company to really like just represent all the time and ride for the brand.
No, well said. Most of the people I have on this podcast actually share the same, maybe it's an age thing, it's a generational thing, like you're saying, say the same kind of, you know, I do think it's so important. Be interesting to see what our guard, you know, our Gen X parents now who have kids and who are going to be entering the workforce in the next, you know, few years to just under a decade, what they're going to be bringing. It's going to be pretty interesting to watch that, because there's been a couple of soft generations. No offense to the majority out there, but there are those. So it will be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I think every generation thinks the generation below them is softer. I just remember like my grandparents being like, okay, yeah, we went through 2 world wars and the depression, and like you punks don't know what it's like, you know. And you know, my grandmother's telling me, you take one sheet of toilet paper, then you wipe, then you fold it, and you wipe again. You're sitting there looking at her because she just went through such austerity that was like what she thought was the right way to do it, you know? And so I think about it, you know, like once or twice a day. Anyways, I don't follow that rule, but I still think that there's, you know, like you watch like kids that are incredibly talented now, and they are all in. And so I wouldn't say that it skips generations. It's just like, maybe not as prevalent because, you know, we've all just been increasingly more spoiled as time goes on, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. Well, let's stay with the theme of work ethic here. So I leave in end of 97, beginning in, I think, January 98 is when we officially kind of jumped. I jumped from Massimo to start Paul Frank. And then we remain friends. We remain in contact. And at some point, I mean, you probably know it was 99, approached us with an opportunity to bring Paul Frank eyewear out into the market. And, I was hesitant. Doing business with friends is always tricky. There's a lot of area for, you know, that sort of like, oh, he's going to disappoint, or I don't want to lose his friendship over this. And how do you make a deal? How do you like monetize your friendship? Like, not that I was thinking about it like that, but the dynamic was important to me. We've kind of been from humble beginnings. We're making $5 an hour. And now I've started this company and it's starting to work. You've left and now you've got this, you know, idea of company and it of company and growth and what you want to do. And it's starting to work. And, you know, I'm really happy we ended up doing that. And you were one of the gold standards of our licensing division. Like, you were the first and probably the best in that whole span of 15 years.
I think I might've been the first and the last. And so, yeah. I mean, just a little insight on that. When I left Mossimo, and they had done their deal with Target, the last thing that I was forced to do, it was kind of funny because they laid me off, or they said that we're ending this division, but we want you to do licensing. And, I would still come in every day cause I just didn't know what else to do. And so, I was trying to find a licensor, but, so through that whole process, you know, like I had to work with the attorneys and I think we did it with a company called Markelin and licensed the name. And so I learned how to license a brand. And then I went to work for Optical Shop of Aspen for a couple of years, working on both product development, for Matsuda, Chrome Hearts. They had a distribution brand, but, so at the end of that, I kind of understood like licensing and distribution deals a bit. And, I just remember like taking that contract, changing the names. I was a man alone in my house. I had a baby, that was just born and I would bounce that baby on my, on my knee and try to put a licensing deal together, but I was man alone in the house without really any resources and telling you that I wanted to do a license for the company. So I'll never forget the moment when we were literally, signing the agreement. And I could just tell us like that you didn't want to do it, but it was there and you had a pen in your hand and you were going, and then finally, like you just signed it and then kind of just said like, I don't know. I think you like kind of left the room or something like that. And I'm like, I hope I didn't like use our friendship, but it was literally like, I was a man alone in the house and you were signing a license with, I guess just belief that somehow I would pull it off.
Yeah. So how did you bootstrap that? How did you finance it? I think a lot of the entrepreneurial journey gets brushed over with the groundswell of success and momentum, but there's little mind, I feel like, paid to the mechanics of the process. So you sign this deal, now you have this, and you're essentially on the hook for taking care of, custodianship of our brand and growing it and growing the distribution channel, which you had none, and royalty payments and employees, which you probably had none. Like, so you're sitting there with a signed deal. What do you do?
Well, I number one, and I would give this advice to anybody. I didn't have infrastructure, but you did. And so, you had a brand, you had trade show booths, you had, sales agencies, you had, like an operation. And so joining that as a licensor, I was able to plug into that. So that was, something where I was man alone in a house and I could make a collection of eyewear. But you had an infrastructure that I could plug into. So we immediately had sales reps. We immediately had, distribution because you already had that. And so I guess that was the main allure of doing that. And then, I guess further, I will say like, there was one moment where I really needed to, make some things happen. And, one of our mutual friends, and one of the best humans on the planet, Jeff Yokoyama, had a clothing brand at the line called at the time called Modern Amusement. And he gave me like an eyewear deal, with his distribution, distributor. And so I asked for like some money up front and they were, he was very gracious at that time. And so that kind of like saved me. I'm like, how am I going to pay rent? How am I going to move this forward? How am I going to get the samples, put stuff into production and everything. So that was really, an instrumental deal. And then, also my father co-signed for a loan, that allowed me to have the resources to enter the game.
Shout out to Jeff Yokoyama, who's been on the podcast.
Oh man. Yeah. He's awesome.
I invite everyone to go into the backlogs of Brevity Code and check that one out. He's a special dude, an absolute gem on the planet Earth.
Yeah. For sure. You find me somebody that doesn't like Jeff Yokoyama and I'll show you a real asshole. He's no so doubt. Sweet.
I agree. So you have now you have Modern Amusement, and you've got Paul Frank. Now you're rolling, and you build that into you open what offices in Europe, and you give me the scope of where that went.
That's a funny one too. I mean, we're in a 10x10 trade show booth in New York, and I meet this English guy that was working for a company that had gained a lot of momentum in Europe. And he really liked the brand. So he said, like, why don't we open an office, like in Europe. And, we didn't have many resources, but this is probably like in year three or four. So we're on the come up and getting, expanded distribution and some traction at retail. And we started our European division from his apartment in Berlin. I'll never forget. He's like, I got an extra room. But it's going to, cost the company $400 a month, to pay part of my rent for the extra room. I remember being hesitant. I'm like, I hate fixed expenses, but I'm like, okay, I'll do it. I kind of like you signing the contract. I was, apprehensive, but ended up signing it. And then it was about like 6 months later, and he's like, hey, I'm in love with this girl that lives in Vienna. Do you mind if I move the company? I'm like, well, we're a company of one right now, so it seems to me like there'd never be a better time, But, then there were two, and then there were six, and 10 years later, we have 23 people operating out of that office in Vienna, like selling Paul Frank and multiple other brands to, over 1,000 retailers in Europe.
Let's talk a bit about your design process. I mean, you're a musician amongst other things, super inspired by music, the brand, Paul Frank and some of the other brands you're working with, have heavy musical influences. And like, when you're designing a collection, what are you listening to? Like, it's different probably now. Cause I feel like we're going to get into a leisure society in a bit where I feel like you're your own muse for the brand. But like back then, like, where were you drawing inspiration? How are you putting together collections, and how did that process work? What was the timeline for eyewear development?
Yeah, I mean, so that's an interesting question. I mean, first of all, at the end of the day, design is just an opinion, and everybody has one, and some people, chains and leather and studs, and other people, cashmere and other things or whatever. And so it's an opinion at the end of the day. With regards to eyewear, I mean, there's only so many shapes that look okay on a human face, and human faces aren't, as far as I know, evolving much. And so you're working within the confines of a limited space. As far as inspiration, it's always, I guess looking a bit to the past, and then out of integrity, not wanting to recreate the past because there's no progress in that. So I would say, we look for classically inspired shapes. And then I think trying to build with any brand, design attributes that are unique. And I look to like great, luxury brands, all over the planet, or for example, the automotive industry. And if you go back to the original Porsches, the original 356 moves into the 911 and continues through their product line today. And when you see a Porsche on the road, you're like, that's a Porsche. And that's great design ethos and attributes that can be played forward and recreated nearly in any product that you put out. And so I've always been a bit obsessed with that. And then, as far as like each collection, I hate it. You can ask the team here. I procrastinate like there's no tomorrow. And then when it comes down to it, we're like, okay, it's go week. And you sit there. But at this time, to bring it to current days, we have probably 1,200 drawings that we know look beautiful on the face. And so we can even go back to Paul Frank drawings or stuff that we created really early and saying like, geez, we love that frame. How would we do it now? With our current brands. So it's an evolutionary process. Right now we're really focused on the master at the art of living. And so anyway, that's.
Yeah. So let's talk about the contrast between analog and technology now, because I feel like I remember you literally hand sketching at the Mossimo days. I don't know that you did that for Paul Frank, but I feel like I walked into that office and saw you hand sketching. Is that true?
Yeah, it is true. Although I will say during, you know, and this would be like advice to anybody that's like, I didn't really finish that from your earlier question. I was in a designer, but when I took over the eyewear division as a young guy, we were paying this design company a lot of money, and I wasn't really getting the results that we wanted from it. So I sat there and looked at the checks that we were writing, and I just said, like, you know, I think I could probably make a go of this myself. So I would just stay on the weekends when the graphic design team was there, and I'm like, teach me Adobe Illustrator. And I would just sit there and have these really like wretched drawings, like, you know, done. But then the team would just go like, okay, we can, you know, help you with that. And so then you're like, here's a nice shape. And truth be told, the first ones were just terrible. And so we're really like trying to, you know, when I was just bragging about having 1200 drawings, I mean, like, you know, the first, you know, ones were terrible, but just really learned it. So, I mean, I would hand sketch things, scan it, and then try to recreate it digitally. It would go to the factories and they would put it into a CAD drawing, three dimensions. And so, yeah, but I still, you know, I still every season, you know, pull out the paper and, you know, make hand drawings. They're a little bit more disciplined now. So I'll usually start with, you know, a size and shape that I know is going to fit well on the face. And then at that point, it comes down to textures and materials and, you know, yeah, you know, different dimensions and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you have to be like really honest of like, you know, did I create anything that's worthwhile? And, you know, a good designer just says like, what I've just created is terrible. And so having the humility to trust your own instinct, and then also just have thick skin when you bring it to other people and they're like, it's a dumb idea, dude. And you're like, okie doke, you know? And,
so how many eyewear designers out there that you know of are doing that hand sketch now versus how much is done, you know, on some sort of, you know, drawing mechanism on the computer?
Well, I think it's very rare. And I think that, and I don't want to, take away from anybody the hand sketches, but I think, you know, now, I mean, there's a lot of like good brands, I don't know, they can use like AI or can say like, you know, what's the top 15 sunglass shapes, in the world right now. And, you simply can recreate that. And so you see a lot of the direct to consumer brands, online, just taking beautiful shapes that they had nothing to do with, and simply putting it out. And I don't know, it's like anything else. It's like, you know, a lot of brands make, you know, white collared shirts. And so you're not going to really like recreate anything, but it's like attention to details, price point, and how the brand feels. So I would say in our industry, there isn't like a super long list of people making, progress or anything new.
Man, I suppose the same can be said for music or most things right now, right? It's just like, you can just hop onto that zeitgeist of what's happening at the moment and piggyback, you know, your Pantone color on some shape and tweak it just slightly. And it just becomes commodity. It's not art. It's hardly design, right? There's no integrity to it. It's a mass play. I mean, I get it. It's a business, but that's not what you and I are sitting here doing or have any desire to wake up in the morning and look at ourselves in the mirror and be like, yeah, that's cool. I'm doing that.
Yeah. Well, I would say you've always had a real sense of, well, you have a wonderful eye when it comes down to style and aesthetics. And I think that's why you started your company, just literally going like, this is so wackadoodle, but, you know, the myriad of like this cartoon basis mixed with, independent music and like really like all the things you loved, and putting it kind of under one roof. I mean, that's the antithesis of like just doing something that's so completely different than anything else. And it's the only way to make a real, you know, run for it. So when you do see these companies become more corporate and talking about trends and everything else, and I think it'd be a real challenge, you know, like I was listening to the CEO of The Gap the other day, and I'm like, God, it'd be hard to go in and rebrand that brand that was kind of branded on just being like, we're the best vanilla ice cream you've ever eaten. And, yeah, people do it. And you know, and that's the strength of like really, really strong brands.
Yeah. Speaking of strong brands and designers, so you work with Marc Jacobs. Can you Do you want to give us a minute on what that experience is like? He's clearly a hero of mine. Like, how'd that come about? What was that?
Well, yeah, I had, I guess, a mutual friend that that knew a person at Louis Vuitton, and they were looking for a designer to like come in and kind of bring some new life to their sunglass collection, which was in its infancy at the time. And so, yeah, I will say that. So they came to a trade show in Paris, and we had just had like a record show. We had like a, you have similar stories from when you're like, I think our company's going to make it. But, you know, we had a phone book full of orders, and we were probably drank a little bit too much champagne too early. But they came to the trade show booth in Paris and said like, hey, you know, there's some people from LVMH here and they want to talk to you. And so I have a conversation with these executives, and they're like, you know, and it was actually like, I guess Mark had seen some of the Paul Frank shades that were being distributed throughout Paris. It was a really hot market at the time for your brand. And, so they just said like, you know, hey, you know, would you be interested in, they found out that I owned the company and I was available and I could do whatever I wished. And they said like, well, would you be interested in working, you know, for LVMH, you know, designing eyewear with Marc Jacobs? And I remember just saying like, well, you know, like I'm super busy right now, so I can't see that happening. But you know, like we should just keep in touch. And then
that's what you said to them?
Yeah, they left. And
why did you say that? Were you posturing, or were you just like,
it was complete posturing? Because I was like, my partners said like, what the hell was that? What are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. Like I heard in couture, you can't be too available. And wow. So believe me, I was just saying like, I'm going to make this happen. But, anyway, yeah. So they came to Los Angeles, and it just so happened that the director of that division, was really into the White Stripes. And, I had some connections to be able to get tickets, and they were playing at the Hollywood Bowl. And so, and you know, I'm always like kind of a grandpa, at the end of the day. So I had like this old Jaguar Vondenplas in 1999. And, which I thought was kind of cheeky because it was like a complete grandpa car. And, anyway, I picked this, executive up and took her to the White Stripes, and, we had great tickets and everything like that, and had a great night. And then, so we hammered out the deal. And so, after that, yeah, it was like, 1 week a month, flying to Paris. I'll never forget the first interview, except before I got the job, I was like, I'm kind of a sweater when I'm nervous. And I also sometimes can, indulge on airplanes. And they, of course, gave me wonderful tickets on Air France. And so I arrived there and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to drink on the plane. Which was like probably a first. And then I got there and I took a cold shower in the morning. And then, I remember all the way down to their headquarters in the middle of Paris, I put my head out the window and just like froze. So I was like so cold when I got there, 'cause I was worried about sweating. And, so anyway, I was sober and cold and got the job.
And what was it like working with LVMH? Like, was there a bunch of bureaucracy? Were they pretty independent as far as like, Mark makes the decisions, he's the creative director, what Shane and I do is not up for discussion, or how did that work?
Yeah. So that's a great question. I mean, first of all, like when I started the job, I spent like 2 days at the family house, like on the outskirts of Paris, where they still do like a lot of custom stuff. And so,
insane. You
know, it was really cool. They were like building, you know, like champagne holders and like dog carry on, you know, like boxes for like sheiks and stuff. And so they still were doing it like in the original factory. And then they have like two stories of like all their archives of like stuff they built through the course of time. And so that was a real lesson in that, like, you know, make something once with the intention of it lasting forever. And you see like the coolest, like, I don't know, like, you know, like champagne suitcases where you'd open it up and it would, you know, it'd be the thing to open the cork, you know, four glasses. And like, this is the coolest thing ever, like, you know, to take on a date or something like that. And then just a lot of the trunks and stuff that they had built. And they talked about the history of, you know, like this guy, Louis Vuitton, that like spent a year walking from his village to Paris. And then he apprenticed for a luggage company. And then he, you know, started gaining his own clientele because he was like a supposedly like a really cool dude, you know, and And then all of a sudden the Industrial Revolution happens. People start traveling on ships. And so the history was like phenomenal, and it really like taught you a lot about luxury. And then further to that, it would be like, let me tell you about Marc Jacobs, and I'll tell you one more story at the end about like just never discounting, never like just making sure your brand's luxurious. But the executives there were like super, super pro and really committed and just calm. Marc was like unbelievable to work with. But I will tell you like some, you know, kind of funny stories, because he was notoriously like kind of a procrastinator too. And he like was legendary for having like a muse like every season. And so I remember one year I went in and like we had a meeting, because I had to figure out what the eyewear was going to look like, you know, a year downstream, and or, you know, kind of 4 or 5 months downstream. And she's like, well, for this season, we're working in pastels, and we have these pastels. And she's like pointing to the wall, and then she's kind of at a loss for words. And then all of a sudden she just loses it. And she goes, and that's all the fuck we have right now. She said, that's all we have right now is a bunch of pastels. Mark's been despondent. He's like, not like on his game right now. And I don't know what we're going to do. And just kind of ranted for another like 5 minutes. And then she took a big breath and she goes, so anyway, pastels is our color wave or whatever. So it was really funny to see like the pressure on the inside. And I will only say like that Mark's like, he was like super genius with eyewear. He knew everything about vintage eyewear. He would talk about like Porsche and Carrera and Cazal and like all these like iconic brands from the '70s. And he really knew eyewear, like, you know, it wasn't like a hobby for him where he just kind of like dabbled in it and said like, oh, let's just make something like that. He really knew his eyewear, and he was super involved in, you know, trying to make sure that everything was perfect. And also just a real gentleman to work with.
Oh, thanks for sharing that story. And also, you know, it's a cautionary tale, right? It just goes to show you, like, just because you're this, you know, global success, amazing forward company like Marc Jacobs was, you know, there still can be complete chaos and, you know, disorganization behind the scenes. It's just glossed over with beautiful ads and beautiful people and beautiful product. But you know, it just
speaks behind to, the like, scenes. It's stressful.
It's chaos getting a collection out, and whether it's eyewear or at the low end or high end, it's kind of all the same, I guess.
Yeah. And so after a bit with Louis Vuitton, like he invited me to work for his brand. And so he was like on the 7th floor in the headquarters, and they only had like, I'm going to say like 6 or 7 people working on his collection from Paris. And so of course I gladly took that job. It was in front of a licensor called Safilo, and they were, it was kind of like, I don't know, it was during the time when everybody was, all women were wearing shields a lot. So I was kind of brought in to have a little bit more of a vintage eyewear influence, I guess, on his collection, because that's what I was doing for you, and that's what I was doing for the other line. But I'll never forget that experience. Somebody told me once, like, I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but it was actually like a really positive, funny thing, but they kind of warned me like, hey, you know, Mark's in a little bit of a funk right now. And his office with only 7 people, you know, like the whole team would eat together every day. So somebody told me like, hey, it's, you know, it's a little tense right now. So, you know, just kind of be on notice or whatever. And so I sat there and everybody's just eating in silence. And so finally I couldn't stand it anymore. And so I just like, I look over and I'm like, so Mark, how's work? And he just starts laughing and he's like, oh man, like I'm just, you know, at this point, you know, where I'm in the go zone and I'm so uninspired and blah, 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 blah. And I just go, wouldn't it be great, like, you know, if you could just like skip one fashion week and the, like everybody would skip it, so you wouldn't like lose any turf and you could just like go on vacation and get revitalized and remotivated and stuff like that. And he's like, oh my god, if we had took a season off, he's like, I wouldn't leave my house. And so we just kind of like laughed about it. But anyway, those kind of conversations are really, you know, for a guy that respects a designer like him so much, I mean, it was really like you're just pinching yourself to have that amount of access. And then also, like, you know, speaking, I guess, further about the company, you know, they were never in a hurry. Like, quality was everything. They were never in a hurry, like, because they would bring prototypes in and they would freeze them and put them through stress tests and all kinds of things. And if anything didn't pass, like, the quality control department, it would just be put off for another season. And, you know, for, like, as a business owner, you're like, well, how can, you know, if we're releasing 10 frames and one of them's not going to go, now our business is down 10%. And if two don't go, it's down 20%. They just never cared about any of that. It was always about, like, long-term, you know, commitment to quality. They just didn't care. And I guess, like, when you're, like, that big and, I don't know, the richest guy in the world, Bernard Arnault, you know, is the chairman of your company, you have that, you know, sense of freedom. And that it really did seem that way there, that money was no object. And everything at that point, well, still is like vertical retail for them. So it was just going to their stores. So
they're operating from a pretty magical kind of unicorn kind of place in business, but you know, they had to earn to get there. And there's a handful of companies on the planet that can do that. So,
yeah, I agree. And there was one, also funny story where, my friend had David Beckham, come into his store and he's like, "Hey man, Beckham really likes these glasses that you did. And I was wondering if he could like get a pair for him." So I'm like, I thought it was like no problem. So I wrote an email, over to Paris and said like, "Hey, David Beckham's like looking for this." I think the frame's called The Evidence. And, I was wondering if he could get him a pair, and I just got it back the next day. And it's like, please direct Mr. Beckham to our Beverly Hills store.
That's like, okay. The rare air right there.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't say no to that guy. No. He's like I love him. That just aired on Netflix or whatever. And like, I don't really care so much about the soccer accolades so much when they showed him and he had his rolling rack in his closet or his room or whatever. Like, this is my outfit for this week. And he had everything like hung and laid out exactly how it was going to go the whole week. And I'm like, dude, goals. Like, it was so good.
And no wonder you're successful in business. You know, it's like, take those things out where you're like, oh God, and you're like, you know, going around, you know, like for everything. My wife and I like are challenged with that a little bit. I'm like, you know, it takes a lot of foresight to say like, okay, you know, like I'm doing this and then I'm working out in the morning, then I'm doing transitioning to this and I have a thing that night. But if you really do the front end work, then life becomes a lot more simple. I'm not saying I do it or can do it, but it makes a lot of sense.
No, dude, what is it? It's Jocko's discipline is freedom, right?
Yeah.
Let's hop over to Leisure Society and talk about, because I feel like this conversation has been evolving, right? From, you know, the Mossimo days, the cage, to married guy bouncing a baby on your leg, designing, you know, to, you know, the evolution of licensing to Marc Jacobs. Now you're at this kind of high end. You've got all this momentum. You've got distribution in Europe. You know what you're doing seasonally. Now you're making collections. Now it's time for Shane to go put his mark on your own thing. So what's Leisure Society all about?
Well, during that time, it was like, you know, Louis Vuitton had said, Louis Vuitton had said, like, we need the designer, like, in Paris. And so, like, you know, we're going to, you know, either got to move over here or we can't extend the contract. And distribution was going really good at that point. And like, I don't care who you are, like, a designer of eyewear is never going to have the house on the hill from designing eyewear. Although distribution and, like, a globally recognized brand is something that could get you that. If you wanted to. So I politely declined the job and all my mentors just said like, look, your resume is not going to get any better. You know, why don't you do your own brand? So one of the, ceilings at Louis Vuitton is like, they wanted to stay, with sunglasses below the $500 price point. And, cause I guess like, you know, their data just said like, if they get above that, like people won't want to buy it. And so I chewed on that for quite a bit of time. Cause I'm like, why does a dude wear a $10,000-$100,000 watch, but you know, with eyewear they'll wear, you know, like I don't know, Ray-Ban or like a mid price point frame, and they'll put $150 to $300 on their face, maybe maxing out at $500. You know, why is that the case? And I don't know. My conclusion was that that there could be more. Well, there'd be no reason to spend more than that because there was no technology or no jewelry like eyewear that that was similar to finely made Swiss watch or something. So I started becoming obsessed with this whole idea of ultra luxury, sitting at a price point above everybody else, but we had to make it more like jewelry. The name Leisure Society came from a social club that I had at the time. And mind you, I'm from a very unsophisticated town of 2,500 in the middle of, the Midwest, halfway between Des Moines and Minneapolis, a little city called Belmont. And so, my level of sophistication was growing up with a box of wine in the fridge and, driving, working in the detasseling corn or walking beans in the summers. And so anyway, going to the top ends of luxury really taught me a lot about branding, which I said previously. And then so when I started the social club, and it was kind of by accident, I decided that we were going to go to opening day at Del Mar. And I started doing some research about it. And I'm like, oh, Bing Crosby, wrote a song about opening day at Del Mar in the 1930s. And he took the train down. So I just put this really extraordinary. And you and I, like I said, we've known each other since we were dead broke. And we've known each other when we're not dead broke. And so when you're kind of enthusiastic about the fact that you can, that you're moving, financially upstream, sometimes you're very enthusiastic about it. So I put this wonderful itinerary together and I just said, good news, Ryan, the limousine is going to pick you up at, 8 a.m. and whisk you off to breakfast at the Four Seasons. From there, you'll take your first class coach down to opening day at Del Mar. And Del Mar is like a race, horse racing track in Southern California in Del Mar. So anyway, I put this fabulous itinerary together and I'm like, geez, this doesn't sound right coming from a farming town kid. So I just wrote on the top, by order of the Royal and Ancient Leisure Society. And so then, when I do other things, because we've talked a lot about how much I like subcultures and just deciding that you can really do anything you want in life if you don't limit yourself. So anytime that we had other things, I'm like, hey, tonight we're going to the opera, gents. And, maybe the night before we went to a punk rock concert, but, the fancier ones were just leisure society events.
I wanted to ask you about this for quite some time. You had an inn. You took me to the Foo Fighters when they weren't even called the Foo Fighters. I think they did a secret show at some small bar in LA. Do you remember this night?
I do. Yeah.
Were they under an alias name?
Well, I think they played under an alias so the show wouldn't get blown out, but they were getting ready to go on tour.
For the first album?
Yeah, I think it was the second album. It was around that time. Yeah. They had maybe just finished the first record.
Anyway, I was stoked on that because Grohl's a huge hero of mine and we were 5 feet away from the stage in this little teeny, it was literally I'm pretty sure there's no way there was 50 people there, 75 people there.
Yeah. Well, I do have an awesome, 5 minute, Grohl story. If you want to segue there,
it's I'm always down for a Grohl story. And then let's go back to how fabulous you are.
Yeah. I just try to stay interested, but anyway, thank you. Yeah. So, we had this friend that, we were going to have an intervention with, because he was a ripping guitar player, but really not so good at drinking. And then, when he wasn't playing for punk rock bands, he was kind of crashing on our couches and stuff like that. So we were kind of gathering his friends and family and just saying we need to talk to this kid. And guys like you and I that love music, but our backup jobs, ended up taking a priority. He had no backup jobs. He had no skills or whatever. So the way that he tells it, he was supposed to audition for this band, at 5 o'clock. And, it came to 5:15. He's like, why am I even here? There's, a bunch of people in Los Angeles, interviewing for this job. The way that he tells it, he went in and this little lead singer is like, hey, thank God you got in here. This other guy wouldn't leave. And so they bust through the 3 songs he's supposed to learn. They say, hey, do you know anything else? He goes, I know everything you've ever recorded. They're like, lead or rhythm? He's like, I could play either. So they play through that. A week later, they go out and party together as a band. I guess he minded himself okay that night because he wasn't the best drinker on the planet. always the one in your crew that may get in a fight or get kicked out or something, kind of liable. But anyway, then he goes to play acoustic with the lead singer, and then he calls like 2 weeks later and he's like, dude, I'm in the Foo Fighters. And so we never had the intervention. he's been, I think, sober now, like 15 years or something more. But anyway, Chris Shiflett, who, you know, plays on the left side of the stage always, was my, a friend at the time, that a mutual friend, and ends up getting into the Foo Fighters right after the first record. So I think that was how we got into that concert. And then, yeah, subsequent to that, I went to his wedding. I will tell you, the first time I met Grohl, I was coming out of the restroom at the church, and I just opened the door and there's Dave Grohl, and I immediately just go, hey, Dave, got a plunger? I'm like, I got a big problem in here. And I'm like, if you don't have a plunger, maybe just like a shoehorn or some WD-40 or something. Like, I'm like, this thing won't go down. And he's like, are you serious? And like, I laughed. I'm like, no. So no. So that was meeting number one. Meeting number two was like, I was on the tarmac in Paris and had a flight canceled. And I go through like a billion different options to get back to Los Angeles. I had a meeting, I think, for your company, and just had to get back for the show that we, or the trade fair that we were having. Anyway, so I go through like 20 different itineraries. We decided I'm gonna fly backwards to Frankfurt. I barely make the flight there. I go to Washington Dulles. I get on the plane, and I look over, and there's a dude with long hair putting a backpack on the top, and he sits to the right of me, and I'm like, Dave Grohl, Chain Bomb, Shiflett's buddy. And he's like, dude, what are the chances? And
I'm stop.
Like, what are the chances? So for the next 5 hours, we drank wine. And this is a little bit ironic because we talked about some things that I was going through with my first divorce and things that I had done wrong. And so we just like bared our hearts and souls. And but it was really weird. Every time I would go to the bathroom, I'd like pinch myself. I'm like, this is really happening? Like, it seems impossible that somehow this, you know, that the synchronicity of the universe or God or whatever you believe in somehow put this together. And so, yeah, it's the start of a nice friendship and like an unbelievable, you know, I don't know how that all works.
Oh, that is cool, man. What a special experience. Thanks for sharing that. I love that. Let's jump back to Leisure Society. Unless did you have a point you wanted to finish? Or
oh, no, I was just saying during that time, I don't know, you can call it the red wine or anything else, but I really like did a deep dive on that. And I bared with him, like my soul, of all the stuff I was going through. And so it was very, unbelievable conversation and one where you're not talking about the weather, you know, you're just talking about, you know, I was asking him about, you know, who his best friends were, how it was to learn, you know, lose Kurt Cobain, how did it affect him, like, you know, mentally. I mean, like I did a deep dive into it when we, we drank a lot, so so it was really fun. I mean, just got off the plane and hugged and exchanged numbers, and it was a meaningful experience for me.
So yeah. Back to Leisure Society. So yes, you come up with the Royal Order of, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And then so we were working with other brands at the time. So we were these are smaller independent brands, but we were doing the distribution in Europe for both Moscot and Barton Pereira. Two brands that, I mean, Barton Pereira just had a sale to LVMH last year. And so anyway, I'm working on some great brands. And so this was like a side project for me. And like I said, I mean, we started out saying like, I want something that looks luxurious without being ostentatious, something that's instantly recognizable from across the room without screaming, look at me. And as I said, like with the Porsche, with the Porsche reference earlier in this conversation, you know, creating a design attribute that's instantly recognizable that can really stand the test of time is not easy. So, you know, we would get some drawings finished, submit them, get the prototypes back. Everybody's like, oh, these are really cool. And I'm like, wow, you know, they're not really like different from anything else. So we worked on it for the better part of 2 years until we finally had one frame where we're like, this checks all the boxes. It looks luxurious without being ostentatious. It has a design attribute that we can build off of. And so I guess that was about maybe 12 years ago, maybe 13 years ago, when we found like we had something to build off of. And so, yeah. And then we also made a simple concept from the beginning. So everything that we make is 12, 18, and 24 karat gold plated titanium. We plate out of gold, not necessarily to be fancy, But we really got obsessed with this whole process called heirloom design, you know, which is making something once with the intention of it lasting forever. So, so the frames are super light, super high tech. They're very classically inspired. The lenses are best in class. So they're all CR39 polarized, 12-layer anti-reflective coating, best in class. They have a diamond cast scratch resistance, which makes them nearly as hard as glass, very scratch resistant. They have a diamond cast coating on it, which doesn't seem important until you're, I don't know, out fly fishing in the mist, or you're sailing and a wave comes over the front of the boat, and so the water comes off like a freshly waxed car. And they come in a leather case, and they have a lifetime warranty.
And what are the price points on that, on those bad boys? They sound like it's going to be astronomical.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody that spends more money on product, and I will only tell you, as an industry insider, you have no idea how cheap a lot of the $300 or $400 glasses that you purchase are to make. But at our level, nobody's spending more money on the product than we are, and we're retailing in the $500 to $1,500 range, but also very limited edition. So we do some smaller runs that end up, getting into the north of $5,000, $5,000 to $10,000 range.
Wow. Are you, and where's the manufacturing done on those?
Everything that we do right now is from Japan. So just a simple story, all gold plated titanium, all polarized, and the collection's just super tight, and all A+ distribution and very slow growth.
Yeah. I love that. I love that whole theory. Are you doing collaborations with Leisure Society and anyone else, or are you really kind of just keeping it your story?
We're not right now. We're working on a sportsman division for next year, we'd like to be, at the top end of athletics. We are choosing old world athletics, and so we're making glasses for golf and for driving and for equestrian sports, and they could be for anything, but. Anyway, so we're working on that, and we will announce some collaborations with that collection next year. That's where we're at right now.
That's amazing and wonderful, and congratulations to you. That's so that brand is 12 years old, you said?
Yep.
I remember when you launched it. Doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but
it goes fast. And to be fair, we've only worked on it seriously. It was a bit of a side project for the first 5 years. And we've been working on it seriously since about 2017.
Are you doing distribution of other brands in the meantime too, or is this what you're doing day in, day out?
We had exits from other brands we were distributing, and this was kind of not getting the attention that it deserved. And so we just got more focus as a company. Just work on one brand right now.
Amazing. That's so fun. Can I ask, you're well-traveled. I think we need to do another podcast. We didn't even get into your hobbies and some of the fun that you have. Mm-hmm. The world is your playground. Is there anywhere where you have not been? I don't know. Maybe I don't even want to ask this question, because we can maybe put a pin in this till next time, but you're a globetrotter, and you as we were talking about inspiration earlier, I'm just curious if there's some place on the planet you haven't been that you're dying to go to.
This is like bragging a little bit, but yeah, I have 3 passports that all had extra pages sewn in during the 10-year span that you own them. So I've been a lot of places. I haven't been throughout India and Mongolia, that part of the world, Nepal, those types of things seem interesting. I think you and I share the love of mountain climbing and stuff like that, although I have no real desire to do it. I think we've watched the same Everest documentaries and that kind of thing.
Those little videos, they do have amazing eyewear, right? Those '70s, Sherpa, they're super hip. They actually looked really good going up Everest. Those early documentaries that you watch.
Yeah, I agree. And so when you talk about inspiration, Ed Visters was the only American that summited all, but all the peaks below above 8,000 meters. And so, yeah, we named a frame after him that was, you know, mountaineering inspired. And so, yeah, I always just try to, like, you know, if you're the master at the art of living, which I aspire to be every day, you're always looking at, like, what's interesting to me. And you're like, you don't really feel like you're working when you're like studying like Ed Visters and looking at cool, like, you know, Everest climbs and stuff like that, and the mountaineering gear that they were using and wearing at the time. And then looking at current technology and saying, like, if you could bring this forward, what would it look like, without, you know, looking super technical. And
yeah, mining that gold. Well, listen, bro, we're at a great point to stop. And like I said, I'd love to do another one with you. just your hobbies and interests, and you've, there's a lot that goes on.
I'd love to do another one. And you know, yeah, it's, that whole thought of like the master at the art of living is kind of important too, because that dives a little bit more into the, like, you know, Huberman type, you know, like, space where you're just like, you know, how do I organize my life to stay motivated and interested and still be a good dad and, you know, good husband and good son and, you know, all of those things. Cause, things do get, you know, complicated, and you can find yourself in little ruts here and there. But, so it's another interesting conversation that I'd love to have with you.
Yeah. Let's do that for sure. All right, bro. Well, listen, this was super fun. It's always great to talk to you. I love the stroll down memory lane and bringing it all the way back to present day and hearing all about, your success with Leadership Society. And, you had a great story. I'm sure there's been a lot of takeaways. I know I learned a ton. So, thank you for doing the podcast, and I look forward to session two.
Thanks, Ryan. I always love spending time with you, and can't wait till we talk again soon.